Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there is this this comforting expectation of absolute precision.
Right, like it's almost a mathematical certainty.
Exactly. It's almost like engineering. You fall off a ladder, you break your arm, the x-ray goes up on the light board, and it shows that unmistakable, jagged white line.
And the doctor just points to it and says, "Yep, there it is. That's the problem."
Right. The evidence is immediate, it's visual,
Yeah.
it is completely irrefutable. But let's take that same expectation of precision and apply it to a crime scene. Usually, when we think about solving a major crime, especially a homicide, we have been totally conditioned by decades of television and movies to expect an explosive, immediate breakthrough.
Oh, absolutely. The classic smoking gun left on the floor.
Right. Or a glaring slip-up caught on some high-definition security camera. We imagine this fast-paced, high-stakes race against a ticking clock where the evidence is just sitting there waiting to be scooped up and put in little plastic baggies.
It is the classic procedural narrative. I mean, society has completely fallen in love with the myth of the 48-hour window.
Yeah, the first 48, right?
Exactly. The idea is that if you don't solve it in the first 2 days, the trail just goes cold. We are incredibly biased toward crimes that announce themselves clearly. You know, a body is found, a perimeter is established, the forensic technicians arrive in their little white suits, and the scientific method just takes over immediately.
But I want you to imagine a completely different scenario today. I want you to imagine committing what you genuinely believe is the absolute perfect crime.
Which is terrifying to even think about.
It really is. And by perfect, I mean you leave nobody behind. None. You methodically, painstakingly destroy the physical evidence with fire, burning it for days upon days until there's virtually nothing left but ash.
Just completely erasing the physical reality of a person.
Yes, exactly. And then the vast, sprawling rural landscape simply swallows whatever is left. You wash your hands, you go back to your life, you literally mow the lawn, you sit down and eat dinner with your family for 8 long years, you get away with it completely, you beat the system.
Which, from my perspective, is the absolute definition of an investigative dead end.
Yeah.
It's the scenario that keeps detectives awake at night.
I can imagine.
The trail doesn't just go cold, it ceases to exist entirely. When the physical environment is actively manipulated to erase a human being, the justice system is often left completely paralyzed, regardless of how strong their suspicions might be.
But then a fracture happens.
Yeah.
And the breakthrough doesn't come from a satellite image or a sudden tearful confession to the police. The earth itself, specifically, a single quiet tree growing on rural 60-acre property, acts as a silent biological witness against you.
It is a profoundly chilling concept, and it perfectly encapsulates the incredible reality of what we're analyzing today.
It's wild.
We're looking at a case where the natural environment retained a highly specific memory of human violence, long after the perpetrator was absolutely certain he had erased it from existence.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, our mission is to unpack a massive, honestly overwhelming stack of sources. I mean, we have been reviewing incredibly dense appellate court records from the Illinois 4th District. We've got all these forensic analysis articles spanning multiple, totally distinct scientific disciplines, and we're looking at a decade's worth of media
There's a
reports.
lot of material to get through.
It really is. Our focus is the June 2010 disappearance and murder of Bonnie Woodward in Alton, Illinois.
And as we synthesize these documents, we are going to see that the resolution of this case defies almost every conventional expectation we have about how homicides are actually solved.
Right.
It is a masterclass in the layering of diverse evidentiary fields. It really demonstrates what happens when human psychology intersects with environmental biology.
Okay, let's unpack this. We need to start at the foundation, which means we need to understand exactly who was lost here. We are talking about Bonnie Woodward.
A real person with a real life.
Exactly. Looking through all these sources, the family statements, the community reactions, all the media profiles, a very clear picture emerges of an incredibly grounded, deeply loving person. She was a 47-year-old nursing assistant. She was a mother of four.
And very deeply connected to her family.
Right. Her brother actually described her as the glue that held their entire multi-generational family together.
Establishing that baseline is absolutely vital. In the field of victimology, understanding the normative behavior of an individual is the very first step in recognizing when a situation has crossed from, a voluntary absence into a potential criminal event.
Right, like, is this person likely to just run away?
Precisely. Bonnie Woodward was a dedicated healthcare professional. She had a strict, very predictable routine. She was deeply embedded in her family's daily lives and checked in with her loved ones constantly. So when a routine like that abruptly shatters, it sends an immediate glaring signal to investigators. They know almost instantly that they are likely dealing with foul play.
Yeah, this wasn't someone who was experiencing a transient lifestyle or someone who had secretly packed a bag and emptied her bank accounts to start a new life on the coast.
Not at all.
The inciting incident is incredibly abrupt. It happens on a Friday afternoon, June 25th, 2010. Bonnie is just finishing her shift at the Eunice Smith Nursing Home in Alton, Illinois. It's around 3 p.m., so the middle of the day. She walks out of the building into the employee parking lot, and then she just vanishes.
She vanishes from sight, but importantly, she does not vanish without leaving a physical trace. Her vehicle, a red truck, is found abandoned right there in that nursing home parking lot.
Which is a huge clue.
It is. But it's the state of the vehicle that is highly incongruous with someone intending to leave it long term. The doors are locked, yet the windows are rolled down.
Right. Wait, which makes absolutely no sense if you are walking away from your car for good or even just leaving it overnight. If you're abandoning a car, you either leave the keys in it and walk away, or you roll up the windows to fully secure it.
Exactly.
Leaving it locked with the windows down implies she was right there, mm-hmm. interacting with someone, perhaps intending to get right back in.
Yeah.
And there were actual eyewitnesses to this, right?
There were. Her coworkers, April Cathers and Wanda Bosley, were in the vicinity. They saw her in the parking lot, and they specifically noted she was interacting with a white male.
Okay.
They described him as being in his 40s. One of the witnesses even noted a very specific detail. This man had his hands resting casually on the driver's side door of Bonnie's red truck, and they both saw a silver or gray four-door vehicle, which they thought was possibly a Chevy Malibu, parked nearby.
What's fascinating here is how rapidly the investigative lens focused on a highly specific suspect, yet how entirely paralyzed the authorities were to actually act on that suspicion.
Mm.
I mean, the police work here in the initial stages was actually quite sharp.
Very sharp. Within a month, investigators zeroed in on a man named Roger W. Carroll Jr. He perfectly matched the physical description provided by the eyewitnesses at the nursing home. And furthermore, he drove a silver Chevy Malibu.
Which is just too much of a coincidence. And there was this bizarre, incredibly tangled family dynamic that connected Roger Carroll directly to Bonnie Woodward. Bonnie had an 18-year-old stepdaughter named Heather.
Right.
Now, according to the records, Heather and Bonnie had a pretty strained relationship. And Heather had actually run away from the Woodward home about a week prior to Bonnie's disappearance. So where did this runaway teenager end up?
With the suspect.
Exactly. She was staying with Roger Carroll, his wife Monica, and their 16-year-old son Nathan.
This specific dynamic is where the complex psychological underpinnings of the case really begin to emerge. The sources indicate that Nathan Carroll actually knew Heather Woodward through a local church youth group.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The prosecution would later argue that Roger Carroll recognized this social connection and actively utilized it to essentially infiltrate the Woodward family's crisis. He presented himself as this paternal savior, opening his home and offering this vulnerable runaway a place to stay.
But it wasn't out of the goodness of his heart.
Far from it. The argument was that this was a calculated opportunity to monitor the Woodward family's internal dynamics and, crucially, to isolate Bonnie.
So if you're the Alton police, you're looking at your murder board.
Yeah.
You have the motive, or at least a highly suspicious, direct connection to the victim's family. You have the eyewitness descriptions of the man in the car, which match your suspect perfectly.
It's all lining up.
Right. But you don't just have circumstantial theories. You get physical evidence. Illinois State Police forensic technicians process Bonnie's abandoned red truck. And right there, exactly where their coworker saw the man resting his hands, they lift a latent fingerprint and a palm print from the exterior driver's side door.
A huge break.
Huge. They run those prints through the database, and they are a direct, undeniable match to Roger Carroll.
And from a layman's perspective, that sounds like a profoundly damning piece of evidence. You have his biological signature right at the scene of the disappearance.
Exactly. So the police obviously bring him in. On September 29th, 2010, Alton Police Lieutenant Scott Golik sits down in an interrogation room with Roger Carroll. And he doesn't beat around the bush at all. He asks him point blank, is there any chance your fingerprints would be on Bonnie's car, specifically on the driver's door?
Yep.
And Carroll doesn't just deflect. He categorically denies it. He tells the lieutenant, there is no way that my fingerprints are on that car door. He forcefully denies ever touching the truck. He denies ever speaking to Bonnie Woodward in his entire life.
Which is, of course, a demonstrably false statement given the rigid forensic reality of the latent prints. Leighton Prinz do not spontaneously materialize out of thin air. He was there, and he straight up lied about it to a homicide detective.
Wait, let me stop you right there. Because if I am on a jury, or if I'm just a normal citizen following this case in the news back in 2010, you have a suspect who demonstrably lies to the police during a homicide investigation. You have his actual fingerprints on the victim's abandoned vehicle. You know he is harboring the victim's runaway stepdaughter in his house.
Yeah, that's bad.
And he perfectly matches the eyewitness description of the last person seen with the victim. It feels overwhelmingly obvious. Why on earth didn't they just arrest him and charge him with murder right then and there? That sounds incredibly counterintuitive to protecting the public, you know?
I completely understand that reaction. This raises an important question, perhaps the most critical legal question in this entire deep dive. It really exposes the stark limitations of the justice system and highlights a foundational legal doctrine known as corpus delicti.
Corpus delicti.
Right. That's Latin, and it translates literally to the body of the crime. Now, in popular culture, people hear body of the crime, and they think it literally means a physical corpse lying on the ground.
Yeah, like no body, no crime.
Exactly. But in legal philosophy, the definition is actually broader. It is the fundamental principle that a crime must be definitively proven to have occurred before you can convict any individual of committing it.
Okay, I think I need a bit more context on that. Why do we have that rule? Where does it even come from?
It actually dates back centuries in English common law, stemming from some highly publicized, truly tragic miscarriages of justice. For instance, in the 1660s, there was a famous case in England known as the Campden Wonder. Three people were executed for the murder of a man named William Harrison, largely based on a coerced confession from one of the accused.
Executed. Wow.
Yes. But a few years after they were hanged, William Harrison essentially walked right back into town.
Oh my God, you're kidding.
I'm serious. He hadn't been murdered at all. He claimed he had been abducted and sold into slavery. So the state had executed three completely innocent people for a murder that never actually happened.
That's horrific.
It is. So to prevent that horrifying scenario, the legal system developed the corpus delicti rule. You must first prove that a specific injury or loss occurred in this case, death, and second, you must prove that the loss was the result of someone's criminal act. Only then can you tie a specific defendant to the crime.
So, bringing that back to Olton, Illinois in 2010, How does the Campden Wonder apply to Roger Carroll?
Well, under Illinois law, and frankly in almost all U.S. jurisdictions, circumstantial evidence like a fingerprint or even a direct confession in some cases is often not enough on its own to secure a murder conviction if you cannot definitively prove a murder actually took place.
Wow.
The authorities knew this. In 2010, they executed a massive search warrant. They brought in specialized cadaver dogs and literally combed across Roger Carroll's sprawling 60-acre rural property in Jersey County. They searched his outbuildings, his fields, his home.
And they found absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all. No human remains, no clothing, no massive pooling of blood indicating a fatal trauma. They had no definitive crime scene.
Man, it's like having a single puzzle piece with a fingerprint on it. The police are saying, look, this piece belongs to Roger Carroll. But the strict rules of the law are saying you can't prove the puzzle even exists unless you can show us the picture on the box.
Yeah.
And you don't even have the box. You have to prove the puzzle is real before you can start locking people up for building it.
That is an excellent, highly accurate analogy. Let's look at the fingerprint evidence objectively, the way a defense attorney would. The presence of a fingerprint on the exterior of a vehicle in a public nursing home parking lot proves exactly one thing.
That he touched the car.
Exactly. That Roger Carroll touched the outside of that truck at some unspecified point in time. It absolutely does not legally prove that he murdered the owner of the truck. A skilled defense attorney would dismantle that in front of a jury in 5 minutes.
I'd just say he bumped into it.
Right. They would argue, my client was walking through the parking lot, he tripped, and he braced himself against the nearest car. Now, the lie to the police, yes, it is highly suspicious. It shows consciousness of guilt. But lying to the police about touching a car is not the crime of first-degree murder.
Right, it's just lying.
Without a body, without a crime scene, without a weapon, the Madison County State's Attorney's Office recognized the harsh reality. They simply did not have the corpus delicti required to meet the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
I just want you to imagine the profound, suffocating frustration of Bonnie Woodward's family during this period. You know who did it. The chief of police knows who did it. The entire community is whispering about who did it.
It must have been agonizing.
It had to be. But the rigid, philosophical structure of the law requires more than knowing. It requires proving. So the authorities tried to get him on whatever they can. Roger Carroll is eventually charged with some relatively minor offenses, obstruction of justice for lying to the police, and harboring a runaway for keeping Heather there. But the main event, the homicide investigation, hits an absolute impenetrable brick wall.
And that wall stood solid for nearly a decade. The sheer geography of the situation worked against the investigators, too. The rural landscape, the dense woods, the total isolation of a 60-acre parcel of land, it acted as a physical fortress.
Yeah, that's a lot of land to hide things on.
It really highlights the staggering difficulty of circumstantial cold cases when the terrain itself works in favor of the perpetrator's concealment efforts. When the earth swallows the evidence, the legal system often just grinds to a halt.
But the physical landscape is really only half the story here. Because we have to talk about the psychological landscape. The thing about pressure, immense psychological pressure, the burden of profound guilt, the terrifying weight of a dark, violent secret shared within a household, is that it doesn't just magically disappear over time.
No, it festers.
Exactly. If that pressure can't express itself outwardly into the legal system through an arrest and a trial, it transfers, it ferments, it becomes toxic. And in this specific case, that immense pressure transferred directly into the psychological foundation of Roger Carroll's own household. And eventually the foundation of that household suffered a catastrophic fracture.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of criminology and domestic psychology, we see this specific pattern frequently in unresolved cases. The ability to successfully evade prosecution in a premeditated complex crime almost always relies entirely on the subjugation of those closest to the perpetrator.
Right.
Maintaining a multi-year conspiracy of silence requires immense, constant, exhausting control. And that control almost inevitably manifests as domestic tyranny.
Let's look at exactly how that tyranny collapsed. We're jumping forward now to March 2018. The case has been ice cold for 8 grueling years. Bonnie's family has suffered through nearly a decade of missed birthdays, empty chairs at Thanksgiving, and the agonizing limbo of ambiguous loss.
8 years is a long time.
The police haven't forgotten, but their hands are completely tied. And then the massive break in the case finally happens. But it doesn't come from some brilliant new DNA extraction technique or a witness suddenly growing a conscience. It comes from an explosion of violent domestic abuse.
This is the psychological long game finally collapsing under its own weight. Roger Carroll violently assaults his wife, Monica Carroll, and the specific details detailed in the appellate records from this incident are incredibly twisted. They reveal the deeply enmeshed, almost surreal, ongoing dynamic between these two families.
Yeah, this part of the source material actually made me stop and reread the paragraph 3 times to make sure I was tracking the names correctly. The physical assault on Monica Carroll, Roger's wife, was actually witnessed by a young woman named Monica Woodward.
Which is just staggering.
That is Bonnie Woodward's daughter. According to the records, Bonnie's daughter had apparently been staying at the Carroll residence. And she was the one who witnessed Roger Carroll punch his wife in the face and literally drag her by the hair down a hallway inside that house.
It is a tragic, almost unbelievable intersection of these two families. The perpetrator of the mother's disappearance is violently abusing his own wife right in front of the missing woman's daughter.
It's sick.
It highlights the pervasive, toxic reach of Roger Carroll's influence. But from an investigative standpoint, it was the specific escalation of domestic instability, the sudden, explosive loss of physical control by Roger Carroll, that finally provided the necessary crack in his psychological armor.
Because immediately after he assaults his wife, the illusion of his invincibility totally shatters. Roger flees the 60-acre property, the police are called, and they are now actively hunting him on domestic battery charges. And here is where fate steps in. A detective named Nick Manns, who was acutely aware of the cold case file on Bonnie Woodward, is part of the search for Carroll.
Talk about right place, right time.
Seriously. Detective Manns eventually tracks him down. He finds Roger Carroll lying unconscious in a densely wooded area far off the main road. Roger has vials of insulin and syringes scattered around him. He is in the middle of attempting suicide.
Wow.
He survives, and when he's later questioned about why he tried to end his life, he admits it was because, quote, he hurt his wife bad.
That suicide attempt is incredibly telling. He realized in that moment that his violent outburst had completely jeopardized the fragile, terrifying ecosystem of silence he had maintained for 8 long years.
He knew he messed up.
Big time. When a chronic abuser loses control in such a visible, undeniable way, the fear of the resulting consequences can be overwhelming. He knew the police were coming, and he knew that once the police started pulling at the threads of his domestic life, the entire tapestry might just unravel.
And those consequences arrived even faster than he probably feared. Because during the immediate fallout of this horrific domestic violence incident, his battered wife, Monica Carroll, decides she has absolutely had enough. She speaks to the investigators, and she reveals a truly terrifying statement that Roger had recently made to her. He had looked at her and told her, "I have killed for you, and I'm a monster."
I have killed for you. Those six words are the absolute catalyst for the second half of this investigation. What is most fascinating here is analyzing the psychological context of that statement.
Right.
As the prosecution would later argue, this was not a man seeking redemption. It wasn't a formal confession made to law enforcement to clear his conscience. It was a calculated tool of ultimate intimidation used within a specific domestic abuse dynamic.
How so? Like, why say it out loud if it risks everything? I mean, why even bring it up?
Because in his mind, it cemented his power. It was meant to assert absolute dominance over his wife. It is a way of saying, look what I am truly capable of. If I am willing to extinguish a human life for you, imagine what I will do to you if you ever cross me or try to leave.
Oh, wow.
It is the ultimate trump card in a domestic dispute. But the profound irony is that by weaponizing his darkest secret to maintain control, he inadvertently handed the authorities the exact piece of leverage they had been desperately seeking for 8 years.
It's incredible when you think about it. He used the memory of the murder to maintain his control, but the act of using it is exactly what destroyed his control forever. With those specific words documented, "I have killed for you," and the pending felony domestic violence charges giving them leverage, the Madison and Jersey County authorities finally have the legal ammunition to officially reopen the Bonnie Woodward homicide investigation. They decide it's time to convene a grand jury.
But we must be precise here regarding the law. An admission of guilt to a spouse, especially an ambiguous one made during the chaotic throes of a domestic dispute, is incredibly powerful circumstantial evidence.
Sure.
But it is not a detailed blueprint of a crime. Saying "I have killed" does not tell the police where the victim's body is located. It does not explain the methodology of the murder. Most importantly, it still does not provide the elusive corpus delicti.
Right. Still no body.
Exactly. To get the actual blueprint of the crime, investigators knew they had to turn to the one person who had been forced to live under the suffocating shadow of that secret since he was a 16-year-old boy.
Nathan Carroll.
Hmm.
Which takes us to what I truly believe is the most harrowing, stomach-churning part of this entire deep dive. We are talking about the blueprint of a murder. Nathan is now 25 years old. The boy who was 16 when Bonnie vanished is now a grown man. The prosecutors subpoena him to testify before the newly convened grand jury. And initially, Nathan does exactly what he was trained to do. He lies under oath. He completely denies having any knowledge of his father's involvement in the disappearance.
Which, from a psychological standpoint, is entirely expected. The extensive psychological conditioning he endured from his father during his formative teenage years, combined with the very rational fear of violent reprisal and his own basic human self-preservation instincts, would overwhelmingly compel him to maintain the lie.
Yeah, you're not going to just flip on your dad right away.
No, he had been living a traumatic lie for nearly a decade. Breaking that requires immense external force.
And the prosecutors apply that exact force. They play extreme hardball. They inform Nathan that they have evidence, they threaten him with perjury, and most importantly, they threaten to rescind a conditional grant of immunity. Finally, faced with his own potential incarceration, Nathan's resolve breaks. He sits down and tells the grand jury, and eventually the trial jury, an hour-by-hour excruciatingly detailed story of what actually happened on June 25th, 2010.
And it's a brutal story.
And it doesn't start with violence. It starts with the psychological conditioning you just mentioned. The prosecution specifically labeled this the othering technique.
Yes, the othering technique is a critical concept in understanding this crime. According to the prosecution's framing of Nathan's testimony, long before the actual murder took place, Roger Carroll began a systematic campaign of psychological manipulation. He repeatedly told Nathan and Heather that Bonnie Woodward was a, quote, bad person.
Just constantly poisoning the well.
Exactly. He painted a vivid picture of her as mean, highly aggressive, and physically and emotionally abusive to her stepdaughter, Heather. Roger told his teenage son that Bonnie needed to go away and never come back. And as the weeks progressed, he escalated that rhetoric, eventually stating plainly that Bonnie needed to die.
Wait, let me just wrap my head around this. If you were planning a murder, why on earth would you talk to your 16-year-old son about it? Why risk him slipping up and telling a teacher or a friend? Why bring a teenager into the fold? It just seems so incredibly risky.
It is risky, but the prosecution argued that Roger was actively conscripting his son into a complex murder plot. But you cannot simply ask a normal teenager to help you commit a homicide out of nowhere.
Right.
To gain Nathan's compliance, Roger had to systematically neutralize his son's moral objections. This taps into Albert Bandura's psychological theory of moral disengagement. By portraying Bonnie as a dangerous abuser, as an active, malicious threat to Heather's safety, Roger was attempting to completely reframe a premeditated, cold-blooded murder.
Making it sound like self-defense, almost.
Exactly. He wasn't asking his son to help him kill an innocent mother. He was manipulating his son into believing they were performing a necessary, almost heroic, act of protection. He was conditioning his child to view the victim not as a human being with a family and a life, but as a legitimate, dehumanized target. It is a textbook, deeply insidious manipulation tactic frequently utilized by cult leaders and severe domestic abusers to foster a sense of shared complicity and trauma bonding.
The level of calculation is just staggering. It wasn't a crime of passion. According to Nathan's sworn testimony, the Carroll family was actually on a summer vacation in Gorville, Illinois, down in the southern part of the state. Roger suddenly decides the time is right. He looks at his teenage son and tells him, this has got to happen whether you like it or not.
Just chilling.
They abruptly leave the family vacation early, driving hours back north to Jerseyville. And along the way, they conduct active surveillance. They literally drive their car through the Eunice Smith Nursing Home parking lot so Roger can physically identify Bonnie's red truck and confirm her schedule.
It is the intelligence gathering phase of a military-style operation. The prosecution pointed out that Roger had already extensively questioned Heather Woodward about Bonnie's daily work schedule, what time she clocked in, what time her shift ended, where she usually parked. He was treating the murder of this woman like a tactical mission.
Then they arrive back at their massive 60-acre rural property. And Roger utilizes this incredibly sinister, heartbreaking luring technique. He orders Nathan to go out onto the property and build a makeshift decoy tent.
A decoy tent.
Yeah. The plan, as Nathan described it, was for Roger to intercept Bonnie, tell her that her runaway stepdaughter Heather was hiding inside that specific tent, and use that lie to lure her deep into the isolated woods.
It is the ultimate strategic deception. The prosecution highlighted how Roger actively weaponized Bonnie's maternal anxiety. He used her desperate, frantic search for her missing stepdaughter as the irresistible bait to lead her directly into a fatal trap.
So the trap is set. Roger leaves the property in his silver Chevy Malibu. He drives to the nursing home, intercepts Bonnie as she gets off work, tells her the lie about Heather, and gets her to follow him back to Jerseyville. Meanwhile, Nathan is waiting back at the farm. Nathan testified that he was inside or near the house when he suddenly heard a rapid succession of gunfire, 8 or 9 shots from a 9mm Stuger handgun coming from an area just behind the family garage.
8 or 9 shots.
Yeah. Nathan walked outside to investigate, and he testified that he saw the lower half of a human body lying on the ground, and the body was wearing tan scrub pants, which is exactly the uniform Bonnie Woodward wore for her nursing shift that day.
That is the execution phase, and it is horrific, but it immediately transitions into the disposal phase, which is where the true, unfathomable horror of Nathan's conscription becomes fully apparent.
Right, because Roger doesn't just call it a day. He looks at his son and tells Nathan not to go back there because it's ugly. Then, according to the testimony, Roger utilizes a piece of heavy farm equipment. He loads Bonnie's body into the bucket of a tractor. He drives her to a remote area of the property and dumps her body into a massive, pre-prepared brush fire.
God.
And here is the detail from the transcripts that is just so hard to shake. Roger and his teenage son stoked that massive fire for days. They fed it wood. They kept the temperature blazingly hot to ensure the complete cremation of a human body. When it was finally over, they scooped up the remaining ashes and dumped them into a nearby creek to be washed away forever.
It represents a profound, almost incomprehensible level of callousness. The prosecution at trial made a very powerful point regarding this specific act. They noted that Roger Carroll didn't just murder Bonnie Woodward, he essentially stole her remains.
Yes.
He actively, maliciously denied her grieving family any sense of closure, any possibility of a funeral, any dignity of a proper burial. And beyond the murder itself, he forced his own child to actively participate in the physical desecration of a human corpse.
Okay, hold on. Let me jump in here, because as a host, I have to play devil's advocate for a moment. If I am sitting on a jury, and I am listening to this incredibly detailed, horrific story, I have some massive red flags going up regarding Nathan's reliability.
Sure.
I mean, Nathan is the prosecution's star witness. The entire case hinges on his word. But let's look at the facts. Nathan had the exact same access to that silver Chevy Malibu as his dad did. Nathan had free access to the 9mm Stoker handgun inside the house. Nathan physically built the decoy tent. Nathan actively stoked the fire for days to destroy the evidence.
He was deeply involved.
Deeply. And, by his own admission, he lied through his teeth to the grand jury to protect himself until the prosecutors threatened his immunity deal. His immunity specifically protected him from prosecution as long as he wasn't the actual trigger puller. So if you're a juror, at what point do you stop viewing Nathan as a traumatized victim of psychological othering and start viewing him as a willing, calculating accomplice who is simply serving up his father to save his own skin? How do you trust a word he says?
That is a phenomenal question, and it is precisely the angle the defense attorneys aggressively pursued during the trial. It is a legally sound, highly effective strategy to create reasonable doubt.
Because it's a very logical doubt.
Absolutely. The defense highlighted the witness's immense bias, his obvious motive to fabricate a story to maintain his immunity, and his clear opportunity to commit the crime himself. As you pointed out, Nathan was intimately, deeply involved in the complex disposal of the body. His hands were incredibly dirty in this crime. The defense strongly argued that Nathan was simply a self-serving accomplice saving his own life by shifting the ultimate blame to his abusive father.
So how on earth does a prosecutor overcome that level of reasonable doubt?
Yeah.
Because it sounds like a classic he said situation between a father and a son.
The prosecution overcomes it by understanding a fundamental rule of trial strategy. Nathan's testimony, standing entirely alone in a vacuum, might not be enough to convict beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
But Nathan's testimony was not just a narrative story. It was a highly specific, geographically precise treasure map for forensic investigators. He didn't just say, "My dad killed her." He gave them exact, verifiable locations. He told them exactly where the shooting happened behind the garage. He told them exactly where the fire was built. He told them exactly what make and caliber of weapon was used.
Which takes us right into the science. Because once Nathan draws this incredibly detailed map, the authorities finally mobilize. It's April 2018. They descend on the Jerseyville property with excavation equipment. They go to the exact area Nathan identified as the burn pit. And you have to remember, it has been 8 years, 8 brutal Midwestern winters and summers.
That's a lot of weather.
Exactly. Roger has repeatedly mowed the grass over this spot. He dumped the main ashes in the creek. But despite all of that, the earth finally gives up its secrets.
The excavation yields critical results. Sifting through the dirt, investigators recover between 25 to 27 distinct bone fragments. Now, to the untrained eye, these might just look like rocks or bits of burnt wood.
Especially after 8 years in the mud.
Right. But a forensic anthropologist analyzed them and testified that these fragments were definitively bone. Furthermore, they showed unmistakable signs of what is called calcination, or extreme burning, which alters the crystal structure of the bone itself.
Oh.
The anthropologist testified the fragments were entirely consistent with incomplete cremation. This physical evidence perfectly independently corroborates Nathan's wild testimony about a multi-day brush fire fueled specifically to destroy a body.
And the corroboration didn't stop with the bones. They brought out metal detectors and sifted the dirt near the garage. The exact specific spot Nathan said the shooting occurred. And they found a 9mm shell casing and a fired projectile buried right there in the dirt.
Just waiting to be found.
The Illinois State Police Crime Lab analyzed that casing, looked at the unique microscopic striations left by the firing pin and the ejector, and they matched that casing directly to the 9mm Stoger handgun that the police had seized from Roger Carroll's home way back during the initial search in 2010.
It is a stunning convergence of evidence. The physical ballistics perfectly align with the son's eyewitness narrative. The gun the police had in their evidence locker for 8 years was scientifically proven to have fired a bullet into the dirt exactly where Nathan said Bonnie was shot.
Unbelievable.
But as we discussed regarding the defense strategy, they rely on poking holes. And the biggest hole they found involved the bones. The FBI laboratory in Quantico attempted to extract DNA from those 25 to 27 bone fragments.
And it was a complete dead end, right? They couldn't get a match to Bonnie.
Correct. And it's important to understand how that happens. DNA is a fragile molecule. It is a double helix held together by hydrogen bonds. When you introduce the extreme sustained heat of a multi-day cremation fire, those hydrogen bonds snap.
They just break down.
Exactly. The base pairs fragment and degrade until the genetic barcode is completely unreadable. The heat was so intense that the FBI could only extract viable DNA from two of the fragments. And when they compared that DNA to Bonnie Woodward's profile, she was entirely excluded as a contributor to those specific two fragments.
Excluded, meaning it definitely wasn't her DNA on those two pieces.
Exactly. The defense leaped on this, heavily suggesting to the jury that the bones didn't belong to Bonnie at all, but rather to animals or someone else entirely.
But the prosecution didn't panic because they were layering their sciences. They didn't just have biology. They brought in digital forensics. Remember, they had seized Roger Carroll's laptop during the investigation. Analysts dug into the hard drive, and they discovered that the specific name Bonnie had been typed into the computer search engines hundreds and hundreds of times.
Hundreds of times.
But here is the absolute kicker. Every single one of those searches happened after her disappearance on June 25th, 2010. The name Bonnie appeared zero times in the computer's history before that date.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of investigative psychology, this is a textbook example of behavioral digital forensics. It quantifies what we call post-defense guilt.
Post-defense guilt.
Right. The perpetrator, having committed the crime, becomes deeply neurotically obsessed with the victim and the ongoing progress of the missing person investigation. He is constantly checking the news to see if the police are getting close. This digital footprint completely contradicts and destroys his initial arrogant statement to Lieutenant Rolleck that he had no idea who Bonnie Woodward was or what had happened to her.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though.
Yeah.
Because you have the digital search history, you have the ballistics match, you have the heavily degraded bones. But the most incredible, mind-blowing piece of evidence in this entire case, to me, is the botanical forensics. The prosecution brings in a specialized research botanist from the U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Service to testify about something called dendrochronology.
It is an exceptionally rare, highly creative, and utterly brilliant application of forensic science in a homicide trial. Dendrochronology is the scientific method of dating tree rings.
So how does this actually work? Do they just chop the tree down and count the circles? Like, do they bring a massive stump into the courtroom?
No, they don't have to kill the tree or bring in a stump. A botanist uses a specialized tool called an increment borer. It's essentially a hollow drill bit that extracts a tiny pencil-thin core sample from the bark all the way to the center of the trunk. This allows them to read the biological record of the environment without harming the organism.
That's wild.
Every single year, a tree adds a new layer of growth called the cambium layer just beneath the bark. Now, when a tree is exposed to a sudden, extreme, localized heat source, like a massive multi-day cremation fire built just a few feet away, the cambium layer on the side of the trunk facing the fire is severely damaged or killed.
So it essentially gets a severe biological burn scar.
Exactly. The tree survives, and in the subsequent years, it continues to grow new rings, but it has to heal over this dead, scarred section. This leaves a permanent, highly visible, and perfectly datable traumatic anomaly embedded deep within the ring structure of the wood.
And that is exactly what they found. The botanist analyzed the core sample from a specific tree located directly adjacent to the burn pit Nathan had pointed out. And the botanist testifies that the tree rings prove scientifically that the tree suffered a massive traumatic event from intense heat. And the specific timestamp for that trauma determined by counting the rings backward. It occurred exactly during the wood growth season of the summer of 2010.
It is profound. Dendrochronologists also use a technique called cross-dating, comparing the rings to other trees in the area to account for things like false rings caused by temporary droughts, ensuring absolute chronological precision.
So there's no way it's a mistake.
None. This tree provided an independent, completely non-human, incorruptible timestamp. It synchronized perfectly with the exact date of Bonnie Woodward's disappearance, and it scientifically corroborated the horrific timeline provided by Nathan Carroll. It proved, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that there was a massive traumatic fire in that exact spot on that property in the summer of 2010.
It's like the digital computer searches are his psychological footprint, but the tree rings are like nature's CCTV camera.
That's a great way to put it.
The tree acted as a biological hard drive, permanently recording the exact timestamp of the fire into its own wood. I just want you to sit with that for a second. Think about how incredible that reality is. A perpetrator can execute a complex murder. He can burn a body to ash. He can meticulously mow the grass over the spot for 8 years. He can throw the ashes into a creek to be washed out to the Mississippi River.
He can do all of that.
But the microscopic cellular growth of a nearby tree is just sitting there in the woods, silently recording the event, waiting a decade to testify against him in a court of law.
It is a stunning triumph of the natural world over human concealment. With the earth literally giving up its secrets through the wood of a tree, the prosecution finally had enough interlocking circumstantial evidence to definitively prove the corpus delicti. They could finally take Roger Carroll to trial.
Which brings us to the legal climax. We are in March 2020. The trial finally begins.
The prosecution's entire strategy relies on synthesis. They know they don't have a body, so they have to expertly weave together the chilling "I have killed for you" domestic violence statement, Nather's reluctant but geographically precise eyewitness account, the obsessive digital searches, the matched ballistics, and the silent testimony of the tree rings into a single, undeniable, cohesive narrative.
Right.
They have to show the jury that while the puzzle is missing the main piece, the body, the sum of these other circumstantial parts overwhelmingly satisfies the requirement of proving a homicide occurred.
And the emotional weight of this trial, reading through the transcripts, was absolutely devastating. Bonnie's brother took the stand and testified that his sister was murdered on his 50th birthday, a day he stated he has never been able to celebrate since.
Heartbreaking.
Her son talked about the agonizing years of ambiguous loss, how she missed military discharges, the birth of her grandchildren, family weddings. The prosecution painted a vivid, horrifying picture of a calculating, arrogant killer who didn't just take a life, but stole the remains to exert ultimate power over a grieving family.
But as we've noted, in the theater of the courtroom, forensic ambiguity is a defense attorney's sharpest weapon. And Roger Carroll's defense team, led by highly seasoned attorneys, aggressively attacked every single piece of ambiguity they could find.
Right. Their strategy was death by a thousand cuts. They hammered home the DNA report, loudly emphasizing the absolute lack of Bonnie's DNA on those two tested bone fragments. They attacked Nathan's credibility relentlessly, outlining his immunity deal and suggesting to the jury that Nathan was the real killer, a sociopathic son trying to frame his innocent father.
They threw everything at the wall.
They did. They even brought up a fascinating alternate theory regarding the bones, suggesting they might be ancient remains from historic Native American burial grounds, which are actually quite common in the rural areas of Illinois.
Which is a completely viable and common legal tactic. The defense does not have the burden to prove an alternate theory. They don't have to prove it was a Native American burial site. They just have to introduce enough plausible alternative explanations into the minds of the jurors to create reasonable doubt. If the jury thinks it's even possible those bones are historic, they might acquit.
But the jury didn't buy the alternative theories. The synthesis of the evidence was just too strong. In March 2020, they returned a verdict: guilty of first-degree murder. Furthermore, they added a special sentencing enhancement because they found, as a matter of fact, that Roger Carroll personally discharged the firearm that approximately caused her death.
A huge enhancement.
Yeah. Later, in October 2020, the judge sentences him to 65 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections. He gets 40 years for the base murder charge and a mandatory consecutive 25 years for the firearm enhancement. And under strict Illinois sentencing laws for first-degree murder, he has to serve 100% of that time. He was 54 years old at the time of sentencing. It is a definitive life sentence. He will die behind bars.
The trial court judge, during the sentencing phase, specifically noted Carroll's, quote, complete lack of remorse. The justice system had finally caught up to him. But a guilty verdict in a complex murder trial is rarely the actual end of the legal road in America. The appellate process immediately begins, kicking off years of further legal wrangling.
And this is where the appellate court records from our source deck get incredibly dense and scientifically fascinating. These appeals stretch all the way up to the Illinois Supreme Court in May 2025. Carroll gets a new team of appellate lawyers, and their primary argument centers on a very common post-conviction claim: the ineffective assistance of trial counsel.
Yes. The new appellate lawyers argued that Roger Carroll's original defense attorneys made a massive unconstitutional error regarding how they handled the bone fragment evidence. During the original 2020 trial, the defense team actually agreed to stipulate to the FBI report about the bones.
Stipulate. Basically meaning they just accepted it without arguing.
Exactly. This means they agreed to let the report, which stated the bones were thermally altered and some could not be excluded as humans, be admitted into evidence without fighting it, without cross-examining the scientist, and without calling their own experts.
The new appellate lawyers argued that this was a catastrophic mistake. They argue the trial counsel should have aggressively challenged the Bohms by demanding radiocarbon dating before the trial ever started. Because as it turns out, after the trial concluded, an expert named Dr. Alexander Chirkinsky actually did perform radiocarbon testing on two of the fragments.
And we need to explain how radiocarbon dating works to understand the appeal. All living things absorb carbon-14, a radioactive isotope created by cosmic rays, while they are alive. When an organism dies, it stops absorbing carbon-14, and the isotope slowly decays at a known, predictable rate. Its half-life is about 5,730 years.
Okay.
By measuring the remaining carbon-14 in a bone fragment, scientists can estimate when the organism died.
And Dr. Chirkinsky's highly precise testing revealed that those two specific fragments came from a species that died somewhere in the 1990s. This is a full decade or more before Bonnie Woodward ever disappeared in 2010.
Exactly. So the appellate argument is forceful. Look at this new science. If my original trial lawyers had bothered to do this test, they could have proven definitively to the jury that the bones in that fire pit were old, completely destroying the prosecution's central claim that this was Bonnie Woodward's cremation site. By failing to do this, they failed to provide adequate legal defense.
But the Fourth District Appellate Court looked at this argument, looked at the carbon-14 data, and flatly rejected the appeal. Why did they dismiss such seemingly exculpatory scientific evidence? I mean, old bones sound like a big deal.
Because the appellate court's reasoning perfectly highlights how the law views the totality of the evidence rather than viewing facts in an isolated vacuum. First, we have to look at the math. Out of the 25 to 27 total fragments recovered from the dirt, Dr. Chirkinsky could only test two.
Just two.
Just two. The DNA experts at trial could only test two different ones. That leaves 23 other bone fragments that were either too small or completely degraded by heat to be tested by anyone at all. The appellate court correctly noted a logical fallacy in the defense's argument, proving that two specific fragments out of 27 are old does absolutely nothing to prove that the other 23 fragments aren't the remains of Bonnie Woodward.
Right. Does the fact that a scientist found some old bones in the dirt make Nathan's eyewitness testimony less believable? Or does it just demonstrate the chaotic reality of an open-air burn pit on a working 60-acre rural farm?
It is exactly the latter. It is a farm. Over the course of decades, animals die. Cows, deer, foxes. Their bones get scattered in the dirt, tilled into the soil, and burned in brush fires. Finding an old bone in a farm fire pit is statistically probable.
It's actually expected.
Furthermore, finding an old bone in the dirt does absolutely nothing to negate the 9mm shell casing found nearby, or the digital search history on the laptop, or the biological timestamp locked inside the tree rings.
And beyond the science, there was a very specific, grim, strategic reason why the original trial lawyers chose to stipulate to the bone evidence in the first place wasn't there. It wasn't incompetence, it was a tactic.
The appellate court agreed with the state that the trial counsel likely made a highly calculated, intelligent choice. Think about the alternative. If the defense refused to stipulate to the FBI report, the prosecution would have been forced to put a seasoned FBI forensic anthropologist on the witness stand.
Oh, man.
That expert would have spent hours walking the jury step by agonizing step through the excruciatingly macabre, horrific details of human cremation. They would have described the smell, the popping of the joints, the charring of the bone, the complete destruction of human flesh.
The defense desperately wanted to avoid that emotional shock value.
Precisely. Experienced defense attorneys frequently stipulate to highly inflammatory, graphic evidence to keep the jury from becoming emotionally overwhelmed and completely prejudiced against the defendant. The appellate court ruled that avoiding a graphic lecture on human cremation was a valid, sound trial strategy, not ineffective assistance of counsel.
So the legal system, after years of appeals, ultimately decided that the sum of the parts, the terrifying domestic violence confession used to subjugate a wife, the reluctant but geographically precise testimony of a traumatized son, the obsessive digital tracks left on a laptop, and the incorruptible biological memory of a tree far outweighed the calculated ambiguity of a few carbon-dated bone fragments found on a farm. The conviction stands firm.
It is a remarkable testament to the resilience and creativity of modern investigative techniques. When faced with the absolute lack of a physical body, they successfully layered forensic osteology, digital behavior analysis, ballistics, and botany to inextricably corroborate a single eyewitness. It is a triumph of interdisciplinary science over human deception.
Which brings us to the end of our deep dive today. We have journeyed from a legally stalled, incredibly frustrating cold case in 2010 months, a case that was utterly paralyzed by the philosophical lack of a corpus delicti, through the terrifying, violent fracture of an abusive household in 2018, all the way to a modern courtroom where the microscopic rings of a tree and a son's literal nightmare secured a 65-year prison sentence.
It is one of the most remarkable, convoluted trajectories in modern criminal justice history.
So what does this all mean for us? What is the takeaway here? We rely so heavily on science to solve our crimes. Mm-hmm. We want the easy answers. We want the DNA swab, the precise GPS tracking data, the unmistakable x-ray of the broken bone we talked about at the very beginning of the show. We want the puzzle box.
We crave certainty.
But this case forcefully reminds us that human psychology, the crushing burden of guilt, the chaotic, unpredictable explosion of domestic violence, the absolute psychological toll of carrying a dark secret for a decade, is almost always the weakest link in a criminal's armor. Roger Carroll built a brilliant physical fortress on his 60 acres of land. He destroyed the body. He beat the corpus delicti rule for years, but his internal psychological fortress crumbled.
He was ultimately undone by his own pathological need to exert control through violence. His supreme arrogance and believing he could successfully subjugate his family forever without consequence is exactly what handed the authorities the keys to his own conviction. The science was merely the tool used to confirm the psychological fracture.
It leaves you with a lingering, almost haunting question to mull over long after you finish listening to this. We know the forensic science in this case was spectacular. The application of dendrochronology was downright brilliant. But what if Roger Carroll had never laid a hand on his wife that specific day in March 2018?
What if he had just kept quiet?
Right. If he hadn't lost his temper, if he hadn't dragged her down that hallway, if he hadn't driven into the woods with insulin, would the science ever have been deployed? The tree rings were always there, growing silently in the dark. The bone fragments and the shell casing were always buried in the dirt. But nobody was looking. It forces us to wonder, as we drive past the dense forests and open fields, how many other perfectly executed crimes are hidden out there in the vast rural landscapes of the world, just waiting for a single unpredictable human slip-up to point the investigators toward the right tree.